Saturday is a sort of relaxed time at the village, and so those of us that make presentations on Saturday, we try to do it kind of casually and even more informal than during the week. Let me give you you're going to be on at 4 today, right? Good. You're going to teach us how to build bigger and better Sunday schools? Okay. Give you a couple of warnings about this morning as we go into the third stage of Kierkegaard, the religious stage. A lot of people get very disappointed with stage 3, and I particularly remember last year where I think I took 6 days to get through 3 stages, so you know you're getting it twice as fast this year. And we got to, I think we had spent almost 3 days on the ethical, which we talked about yesterday, and so we got to Saturday and we got to the religious, and the gang were all in anticipation. You know, this morning the light was going to dawn and everything was going to be great, and they'd have the whole business licked. And I got done with Kierkegaard, you know, everybody just sort of looked at one another, and finally there was a pastor that was sitting over here. I think he was a relative of Carol Hinderle's, and he was sitting over here and he held his hand up, and I said, "Yeah," and he said, "I always thought Kierkegaard was a nut." So I hope you might have a little different reaction. But what is going to be frustrating today is when we're talking about this third stage, you must constantly remind yourself that we are moving beyond the rational. This is not irrational, but it is beyond the rational, and we will always want a rational explanation. And they aren't there, because we're beyond the rational. You know, and so you want to say, "Yeah, but how come, you know, you're trying to make sense out of this and you're trying to make sense out of that." The assumption being that if you can't make sense out of something, it's wrong. And what is happening here is we are getting into an area of experience which includes the mystical, but it's not limited to the mystical. I suspect Indians are more at home there than Americans are in this aspect of life. But, we're trained in the Western tradition to syllogize about things and to make logical systems and get everything organized and fitting nicely together. And we're moving into an aspect of life where it doesn't work that way. And so there's a certain element of frustration about it, and some of the traditional Lutheran hang-ups start looking like they're about to emerge here. Like some of the traditional Lutheran problems have been questions like, is the will free or not? Why are some people saved and not others? And these are, you know, you're going to start all of a sudden find yourself saying to yourself, well, how come God does things this way, not that way? You know, how come this one and not that one, and so on? So with these warnings, let me move ahead. The last thing I mentioned very briefly yesterday was the highest ethical figure that is achievable is the tragic hero, the hero of the Greek classical tragedy. The human being who suffers some great loss or is lost in all innocence, the Job figures of life. And the ethical stage of life is pushed to its limit and can go no farther when we get kind of events that occur and we say things like, why does evil happen? Why did this have to occur? Why this person rather than another? I suppose maybe one of the key ethical questions of life, which a purely ethical approach cannot answer, is why do people die? And there is no rational explanation. Oh, we can give a physical explanation, you know, and write it on the death certificate or things like that. But we cannot give a rationally satisfying answer to the question, why must life end in death? Because the rational answer to life has to be life would not end. And those of you that are familiar or have some familiarity with Plato's works, you know that Plato wrote several of his early dialogues, the Crito and the Phaedo, which are Socrates discussing with his friends in prison whether or not there is a life after death. And they come to the rational conclusion that life must be continuous, it must go on. But this doesn't answer the question, why, if life must be continuous and if life must go on, why does there have to be this physical thing called death? It doesn't make any rational sense. And I suspect that this is part of the reason why we find it so difficult to work with and to handle and to face and to believe in our own cases, because I suspect that until we really get really arthritic, or we have to walk slowly so we don't crack an artery, they're so hard that we really don't believe on our own mortality or that it could happen to us, because it doesn't fit into any reasonable system that something like that should occur. All right. Well, and so the tragic hero is about the closest on the ethical level that one can get to ethical perfection and to, you know, the perfectly satisfying life. And it's ironic, because the tragic hero really is hurt. You know, he doesn't live in the best of all possible worlds. He has the worst of all possible worlds. And yet this is the highest that the ethical level can achieve. And our feeling is there has got to be something better than that to look forward to. Just like there's got to be something better to look forward to for a whole life than, you know, the kind of life that is pictured in the old pop song, Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries, you know, where you da-dee-da all the way through life from one delightful experience to another, which we already know gets to hang out after a while. Well, there also then must be something beyond the ethical. But since the ethical is the rational, there is no way rationally that we can think of a better life, because to think of a better life would be to think of a rational life. And so consequently, this is as far as we can go reasonably, and this is why usually this is as far people have gone. And this is why when you ask what is the academic discipline which concerns itself with how we should live, the answer is ethics. And we educate ourselves and we learn to use our brains so that we can figure out what we ought to do, and we train our kids so that when they grow up they can find their place in the system and successfully cope with commuter schedules and strikes and who knows whatever else in the hurly burly of existence. And yet, every once in a while, we run into kind of situations that go beyond the ethical, and where neither the aesthetical nor the ethical levels can handle them. And one of these is the life of a man who, for Kierkegaard, is the paradigm man for the religious level, Abraham. If you remember the book of Hebrews, Abraham is given as the model for faith. And in his book, Fear and Trembling, Kierkegaard devotes his attention to a very detailed analysis, psychological analysis, of the experience of Abraham when one day, suddenly out of the blue, God came to him and said, "Up and take your son Isaac to a place which I will show you and sacrifice him to me." You remember the event. And Abraham is going to be the hero of faith. Kierkegaard liked the expression knight of faith. Abraham is going to be the knight of faith, unlike the tragic hero of the ethical level, Abraham will be the guy who will give up his son, like Jephthah had to give up his daughter, and he'll get him back again, which is better than being a tragic hero. See? Okay, what's involved in it? God says to him, take your son Isaac and kill him. From an ethical standpoint, what is God telling him to do? God is telling him to do something evil. So if we look at it from an ethical standpoint, God is calling on Abraham to do something which is evil because it's against the fifth commandment. You aren't supposed to kill anybody. God is telling him to kill his son Isaac. He is an ethical man. He ought not to kill his son. From an aesthetical standpoint, God is telling him, destroy the pleasure of your old age. You remember, Abraham was an old man, as was his wife. They had no other legitimate children. Isaac had come as the joy of their old age, and he's a young boy now. He may have been 5 or 6 years old enough to still be cute, and old enough to ask questions that are embarrassing, like, Daddy, where is the lamb? Which must have really torn his father's heart at that point. So from an aesthetical standpoint, God is asking him to give up his pleasure in life. And if he's killed his son, you know, life will be totally empty and totally gray for him for the rest of his life. Now there's a deeper significance to this, and it lies in this, that Abraham is never going to have any more children, and Isaac is the son of promise. From Abraham's seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And so somewhere down the line through the generations, someone is going to come who is going to be the blessing of the world. And so consequently, if Abraham kills Isaac, everyone goes to hell. That's it. We're done. So it wasn't even as simple a thing, and I realize that sounds kind of cold-blooded and ironic, but it wasn't even as simple a thing as a father killing his son. But it is a man called upon by God to destroy the hope of existence.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more evil, or is the command to sacrifice your son, your only son,
mm-hmm.
absurd? Because there are many people, you know, other, even than those who read some of the other existentialists, who say the world is basically absurd and all we can do is try to detour around that which is absurd and make it through anyhow.
Yeah, of course, now Kierkegaard would not agree with that interpretation of absurd. This is why most existentialists since Kierkegaard have not understood Kierkegaard. What Kierkegaard means by absurd is that the universe is not reducible to a totally rational system. In other words, there are openings in it, and because there are openings in it, God can work his will, and he is not bound by a system. There are surds, there are disconnections, discontinuities.
But,
and so it is by means of the surds that the religious level is possible. Now what you get in 20th century existentialists is the world is irrational. It's absurd. It doesn't make any sense.
So ethics is not possible?
And so ethics is not possible. Kierkegaard would say ethics is eminently possible. As a matter of fact, the religious level is not anti-ethical.
Well, Kierkegaard bridges all the gaps of faith.
Well, no, faith works through the holes. See, reality is like a netting.
Well, that's what I mean.
And so it can go right through, yeah. And you can't, with Hegel, reduce the whole thing down to a system. See, this is not a deterministic universe. It leaks all over the place. And so God can do what he wills. And with God, nothing is impossible, and it would be a height of absurdity in the 20th century for God to create a universe that was, you know, like the deistic conception of the universe. It runs by itself. See? No, he's in there. He's involved with it all the time, and he certainly wouldn't put one together that he couldn't work with, that he couldn't interact with and do things with. And so this is why when he's talking about the level of the religious, he's always saying, well, this is possible because of the absurd. This is possible, and it happens because it is absurd, because it is by means of the absurd. You know, in strict good Latin, you know, by means of. It is by means of the absurd that God does this. Well, you get into Sartre and you get, makes no sense. That's what absurd means. And so since this is a universe that is strictly a factual universe, it has value, is purely subjective. All you can do is use an expression that Vern used this morning. All you can do is, you know, try to avoid getting sick to your stomach whenever you can. You know, avoid nausea, but it's a nauseous kind of existence, and you tolerate it, and you try to get out of it what you can. Well, what happens in Sartre and others is they're reverting back to the aesthetical and don't know it. And any kind of reversion automatically is psychologically wrong, and it's not going to work, and so you end up with kind of hopelessness. But you don't have that in Kierkegaard, only they don't know it. Because this notion is absurd, because they interpret it wrong. Now, of course, you have another element in Sartre, and Sartre has no room in his thinking, you know, for a divine function. And he takes an expression which he took from Dostoevsky. Either God must be free or man must be free, but they can't both be free. I am free, therefore God cannot be free. The idea of an unfree God is nonsensical, so there is no God. I am free, off we go the races with existentialism as we understand it today. See? And you start with one fact, I am free, which eventually ends up with the inevitable conclusion, I can't escape myself. Solipsism. And that's, you can't go any farther than that. And that's where he's stuck. You can't go anywhere from that. You got no substance. You got no content you can work with. You can't get beyond the aesthetical in terms of the stages. You can't get from subjectivity to objectivity. You got to get to objectivity before you can get back to a livable subjectivity, or a subjectivity that can survive. Other than that, you're simply worshiping your navel. And so, consequently, Kierkegaardian existentialism is optimistic, and one of the ironies about it is that virtually no existentialist has gone that way since him. I suspect primarily because most of them have been conditioned by Nietzsche, at least the third Nietzsche, the voluntaristic Nietzsche, who was, of course, strongly influenced by Schopenhauer. And so the Schopenhauerian pessimism has created a kind of existentialism which is really self-defeating. And it just, all it can do is create a terrible urgency which it can't satisfy. You know, there's this strong ethical demand that you feel a need to respond to, but there's no way to do it. You know, so what do you do when you're in frustration? You know, strike out.
Yeah, my
ego moves.
The first definition I ever heard in a classroom of existentialism was a blind man in a totally dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there.
Well, yeah. Heard that from a Roman Catholic theologian about Martin Luther, too. So that's a very useful ploy for any system you're against. No, but there's a very real sense in which that is true of the typical existentialist approach, because you start out with an active nothingness and you fulfill it. You know, and if to use a famous quotation, a slight revision of a famous quotation, what you feed into the computer, you get out. You know, you feed nothing in, you get nothing back out. And that's the trouble with that kind of variety of existentialism. And so it is incapable of a viable ethical level. And Sartre's beautiful example of it, because after Sartre wrote Being and Nothingness, which purported to be his metaphysical work, he said the next thing out is going to be my ethics. Well, we're still waiting for it. And he's a pretty old man, and there isn't going to be any. He thought he was going to get it by means of communism. And he joined the Communist Party, and he studied communist doctrine for about 10 years, and he says they haven't got it. And he couldn't work through them. And since then, he's been pretty quiet, other than, I think, in a little essay that I saw once and made the mistake of not duplicating it. It was kind of circulating among philosophers. It wasn't published. He just sort of admitted about as much as most any philosopher is willing to admit failure. Sort of admitted that he didn't know. He couldn't work his way into a viable ethics from his metaphysical viewpoint. It just wouldn't work. So, most of your 20th century existentialists have been pretty hopeless. And, you know, Sartre, Camus, even Jaspers, and the ones that have been hopeful even there have had to try to shift over into something else in order to try to get some kind of foundation. And what, in terms of what we've been talking about, they have been unsuccessful in getting from the existential to the ethical level. And then, of course, they can't get a religious level at all, which we haven't gotten to yet. We better get to it. Okay, so we have gotten as far as we can get with the ethical level. At the same time, by virtue of the fact that there was an Abraham who was called upon to perform an act which he was unable on either aesthetical or ethical grounds to perform. And yet he fulfilled the will of God in what happened. And everything worked out fine, and aesthetics got satisfied, and ethics got satisfied, and religion got satisfied. We realize that there is a stage of life which is beyond the ethical. Now, as human beings, we are all, regardless of what our theology is and regardless of what we claim, as human beings, we are by nature Pelagians. You remember Pelagius way back in the days of Augustine, who was the father of work righteousness, you know, or you earn your own salvation. That same urge which leads us to institutionalize religion that we talked about, among other things, yesterday, that same urge causes us to want to figure out religious level answers. Leaves us discontented with mysteries. I suspect that it's the foundation of systematic theology. That because systematic theology is unless one handles it extremely carefully, is an attempt to explain everything theological. And this is why Vern said this morning, the systematic theologians know more about God than God does himself. Because that's the kind of approach to which systematic theology is committed, unless you use the right kind of method, which is, I suppose, about the best kind of method of doing systematic theology is the method that Augustine used, and I like to call it the reverential method. And you write your systematic theology in the form of prayers, where you talk to God. And that's about the closest you can come to avoid trying to bring the third stage down to the second stage and make an ethical structure out of it, to which then people have an obligation to be committed, because anything that is ethical, automatically you ought to be committed to. See? And so if you pull it down to the ethical stage, structure it out, you know, everybody has to believe it, because by golly, if you don't, you're bad. See, but all of a sudden, you're not on the third stage anymore. You're back on the second stage. And you're structuring it out and you're revealing all the mysteries. Okay, now, the third level we want to attain. And this is why oftentimes, unwittingly, we call on people, we lay the information about God and Jesus Christ on the table, and we call on people to make a decision for Christ, right? I'm sure you've all heard that expression, make a decision for Christ. The most terrific ethical move you can make. Terrifically Pelagian. Really great. Except that it's not theological, it's on the ethical level. And we always want to do that, don't we? We talk about the third article and the explanation of the third article. I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in Jesus Christ my Lord nor come to him. But on the 15th of August 1957, I made a decision for Christ. Right? Which is an absolute contradiction of what we've just said. The third stage happens to us. We don't move to it. And whereas we move from the first stage to the second stage, the third stage comes to us because it is something that God does. Which is not very reasonable, is it? It's much more reasonable that we do it. But we've moved beyond the reasonable. And so God does it. What is even more unreasonable is he doesn't do it to everybody. And why he doesn't do it to everybody, we don't know. Nor can we. Because if we could know, it would be ethical. It would be on the reasonable level. And so it's awfully dumb to ask why some rather than others. Because as soon as you ask the question, why are some people saved rather than others, you are saying theology is an ethical matter. Because you are asking an ethical type question, a rational type question of something which is beyond the rational level. All right, so God does something to people. And they are now able to live not by reason of their reason, but they live by the love of God. And this is, Kierkegaard says, this is why St. Paul says, you are freed from the law. You are now in the third stage. You're not in the second stage anymore. And anybody that tries to get you to live on the second stage, they don't know what they're talking about. Now, the reason why they try to get you to live on the second stage is because they believe that if you live on the third stage and you live by the gospel, you will be anti-ethical. And what they don't realize, and many existentialists don't realize, and this is part of Kierkegaard's conservatism, and that is, if you are successful on the third stage, you are also successful on the second level and on the first level. The big problem of people that don't have the first and the second level right, and a beautiful example of this is Immanuel Kant in his ethics. Kant's biggest problem was, how can you be ethical and happy? And, you know, how can you reconcile the aesthetical with the ethical? Well, he obviously had his ethics screwed up. You know, and if we had more time, I'll show you how, but he had his ethics screwed up. You know, well, we've had our notions of law, at least in the Lutheran Church, screwed up by Kant ever since. You know, and so we get Kant's problems. And so the individual who's on the ethical level and who says, how can a person be a Christian and live without the law? He's got the ethical level and the religious level screwed up. The answer which Kierkegaard gives is not a rational explanation, you know, because you can't. The answer that he gives is, there goes one right now, watch him. See? Watch him, and you'll see. And he has a charming section I mentioned to, you know, about a quarter of our gang left this morning, you know, and I saw him off at the bus, and he said, I'll write for a tape to see what happened. Oh. I mentioned to one of the ladies yesterday, a charming little section in Kierkegaard. He says, what is the night of faith like? You know, we all know what the tragic hero is like. You know, the sort of guy that's given the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously, and movies are made about him, starring John Wayne, and so on, you know. We know what that's like. What is the Knight of Faith like? He must be even greater. And he says, he looks like a shopkeeper. Just an ordinary Joe. But he's handling it. How can you tell it's a Knight of Faith? He's got it all together, to use an in expression today. It's working for him. He's a very obvious son of God. He's living in the light of eternity and the joy of salvation. You know, and he's making it in the system, and he's happy. That's the Knight of Faith. All three levels are working well with one another. Now, on the third level, I mentioned to you, you know, that the first level was life lived oriented around one's feelings and emotions, and you satisfy your desire for pleasure. The ethical level is oriented around the rational faculty. The religious level is oriented around the will, the voluntary faculty. And where one lives by the love of God, which rises in one's heart. And quite literally, this is one's motivation. This is what moves you. You want to do this. You want to do that. You want to do the other thing. And this is how you live. And when it is the will of God that is in you, and that is moving you to want to do this and want to do that and want to do the other thing, it is consistent with the ethical. But it is not because of the ethical that you do what you do. And what makes it even better is the fact that there are kinds of situations like the Abraham situation where the ethical can't tell you what to do. Because if Abraham had gone by ethics, he would have disobeyed God, right? Mm-hmm. And so he couldn't go by the ethical. If he had gone by the aesthetical, he would have disobeyed God once again. Maybe he'd have taken Ishmael up there and sacrificed him or something like that. But he loved God, and he didn't know what God had in mind. There was no way of knowing how this thing was going to turn out. Kierkegaard makes a great deal of emphasizing that Abraham's faith was not a Pollyanna kind of faith. Abraham didn't go to that mountain, and it may very well have been the very same place where centuries later the temple was built, where Jerusalem would be. But he went to that place, and Kierkegaard says he did not go to that place believing that somehow, some way, everything was going to turn out rosy good. As far as he knew, his son was going to be killed. Reminds me a little bit of a section in Luther's introduction to his treatise on the Ten Commandments, where Luther involves himself in the question of degrees of faith. How would you measure faith? You know, because we talk about stronger and weaker faith, don't we? How would you measure that? And he gives a very charming empirical kind of test. And he says, well, of course, a test of faith would be how much temptation it would take to destroy it. What would the strongest kind of faith be? And he said, well, as far as I can tell, the strongest faith would be of the human being who throughout his entire life loved and trusted in God. Everything went wrong. He died in agony, woke up in hell, and said, praise be the Lord. He then said, God, of course, would never do this. But he says that's the strongest faith there could be, where all empirical conditions would contradict your confidence in God. And so, consequently, on this third level, we have the man who does it all. And he uses, in another place, Kierkegaard uses the image of the dancer. And he says, talking about three different kinds of dancers, and you can readily identify them. The first dancer is the one who goes out on the dance floor, and he flits around here, and he flits around there, and then he gets tired and goes and sits down. And the second dancer, my favorite dancer in the example, the second dancer gets up and it's, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Following the Arthur Murray footstep. That's the ethical guy. You go by the rules. See? Following the Arthur Murray footsteps. See? And the third guy is the guy that, as far as you know, has never danced before in his life, and he just floats around effortlessly. He's got all the reflexes. Well, the Knight of Faith has got all the reflexes, all the spiritual reflexes, and they come from God. Kierkegaard thought that he himself didn't have all the reflexes. And matter of fact, he thought that he himself was kind of hung between the ethical and the religious. And he called a person that couldn't quite pull it off. You know, he didn't quite have courage enough to be, to use a Paul Tillich expression. He called him the Knight of Infinite Resignation. Sounds almost like Don Quixote, doesn't it? Knight of Woeful Countenance. The Knight of Infinite Resignation. He knows what it's all about. He knows what dancing is like. He wants to be a dancer, and he's got two left feet. He can't quite pull it off. And Kierkegaard said, you know, through my whole life, I couldn't quite pull it off. I got engaged to this lovely girl, and I couldn't quite marry her. You know, so we broke it off. And he never, you know, he was faithful to her till death, left his whole estate to her when he died, which embarrassed her very much, because she was happily married with three children, and her husband was in the diplomatic corps, you know, and childless, we are youthful sweetheart leaves her all of his writings. Now she got over that and saw to it they got published, and probably is responsible for the beginning of his European reputation, early part of this century. He studied for the ministry, and he couldn't pull it off. He probably could pull it off because he just couldn't see himself fitting into the state church structure of Denmark. He couldn't see him as a typical Danish clergyman. Maybe he was allergic to preaching to empty pews. You know, couldn't handle that. You know, because it was that way in the last century, probably worse than it is today. But he just could not be a functionary. So he couldn't handle the aesthetical. He could get himself engaged, but he couldn't move beyond that to marriage. He could handle seminary training, graduate, be ready to be ordained as a clergyman, but he couldn't handle moving into the ethical structure and moving people beyond that to the religious level of experience. He also thought that the Church of Denmark couldn't either. In his latter years, most of his writings were attacks on the Church of Denmark, the institutional Church of Denmark. And typical a remark of his was the trouble with Christianity was it had been destroyed by Christendom. Now, Christendom is the organized church, and Christianity is what in 17th century theology was called the invisible church, you know, whatever that is. But the true believers. He came to the reluctant conclusion that he might very well be the only authentic Christian living in the whole world. And, you know, other things that endeared him to his fellow Danes. And when he died, well, when his father died, his father left him quite a good deal of money on which he lived for the rest of his life. Most of it he spent publishing his books, which didn't sell. And he wrote a great many books, but they just didn't sell very well, and he certainly never got his money back on them. And in the last few years of his life, he was very worried about whether his money, what he was going to do when his money ran out, because he was extremely unpopular and hated in most circles, at least religious circles. And he had never worked in his life. I mean, he'd never had a job. He was trained to be a clergyman, and at that point it was quite obvious that nobody was going to give him a parish after what he had said about the Church of Denmark. So he didn't know how he was going to survive, and one of the interesting facts of life, of history, he went to the bank and checked out the last money that he had left in his savings account, and on the way home he had, well, probably was a stroke, and collapsed in the street. He was taken to the hospital, and he died about 4 or 5 days later. And his money just lasted. And he was, his younger brother was a clergyman, and he had a close friend who was a clergyman. And a close friend who was a clergyman in Copenhagen, and came to attend him in his last days and hear his final confession, and concluded that he was a Christian, but he could not give him communion because he was not a member of the organized church. Faithful to ethics to the end. And so Kierkegaard died without the sacrament of the altar, which for which he had asked. On the other hand, let's say in deference to the other guy, Kierkegaard insisted that if he got the sacrament, he was going to serve himself. So he was a rebel to the end, too. So it was a kind of a standoff at the end. And his brother had a parish some distance away in the country, and his brother took a few days before his brother was able to get free to come and see him. But his brother was with him at the end. And he died quite peacefully, and apparently what he was most peaceful about was this terrible worry that he had had for a number of years about finances was gone. He knew it was going to last. He also had been concerned for many years because his father had been a very melancholy person and who all his life had been afraid of dying, because he believed when he was a young boy, young shepherd boy out on the barren wastes of near Jutland, he believed that as a boy, life had been so difficult for him, and it was so cold and such hard work, and he was a young kid working long hours. He believed that he had cursed God and that he had been guilty of the sin against the Holy Ghost and was eternally damned and could never be forgiven. And so they were never able to rid his father of that belief, and his father died in great depression. And Kierkegaard happened to be present at the time, and so he was afraid that was the way he was going to die also. Instead, he died very happy and contented, and you know, as far as we can tell from his writings, in the faith. So then the big question was burial. They didn't have the honorable custom in those days that let the undertaker do it. You know, somebody had to bury him. Some clergyman had to bury him. Well, his brother said, "I'll perform the funeral." And to this day, we don't know why, but the funeral was scheduled for the cathedral church in Copenhagen, which was the biggest church. The dean of the cathedral happened to be out of town, and through some kind of mix-up, the funeral got scheduled from that church, and the dean got back. He was furious, but it was a well-known family in Copenhagen, and so he really couldn't do anything about it but grit his teeth. People that got angriest about it were the students at the university, you know, who to a man were behind Kierkegaard, you know, big typical rebels. You know, they right on, Soren, you know, the establishment has gotten our friend. We're going to rescue him from the establishment. They hated him when he was alive, you know. We'll be hanged if we're going to let them bury him. So they came to the cathedral. You know, the establishment people came to the cathedral. I don't know who sat on the left and who sat on the right, but they didn't sit with one another. And Kierkegaard's brother and the local police, you know, they all sat there very edgy, hoping that there wasn't going to be a violent explosion there in the church. Well, there wasn't. But when they got out of the church, the students grabbed the casket and they pulled it out to the cemetery, to the place of burial, and they began delivering speeches on behalf of Søren. And Søren's poor brother was tearing his hair out. And somehow or other, they finally got him buried. So at any rate, the aesthetical, the ethical, and the religious, they sure didn't get together. So there's Kierkegaard. Yes, sir.
As I remember reading in the section describing the night of faith.
Yeah.
I remember getting bored with the description.
Oh, sure.
I anticipated so much.
Oh, yeah.
Here's this guy, gets up in the morning, looks in the mirror, shaves.
Yeah, that's right. Very ordinary guy. Yeah, and Kierkegaard says it's...
That.
Yeah, and Kierkegaard says, and yet the remarkable thing about it is every move he's making is an eternal move. You know, it's a move that God is completely aware of, and he knows it has eternal significance. You know, every move you make has something to do with your eternal relationship to God. And he's very aware of it. You know, but he's not, you know, cutting himself all over because he's scared he's going to make the wrong move. You know, just like in the athlete in the shaving commercial, you know, doing things we wouldn't dare do. No mirror, nothing. And he keeps talking to you. That's the night of face shaving. Yeah, he's an ordinary Joe.
Seems to be Kierkegaard himself, maybe without knowing it, was this ordinary joke.
Now, Kierkegaard couldn't handle the ethical. He couldn't handle the establishment. They hated him. He was just kind of hung in between. He couldn't quite make it. He knew how it should be done, and he couldn't quite do it. He couldn't get his books to sell. He couldn't get people to understand what he was talking about. He couldn't get them to realize that they had reduced religion to ethical behavior. And he knew what the right answers were. He couldn't even describe the night of faith in an exciting way, you know, as you're just talking about. But, you know, for us ordinary Joes that aren't internationally celebrated or anything else like that, there's an awful lot of comfort there. See, because you hark back to the gospel and Jesus' description of Judgment Day, when all the big guns march up there and say, all right, Lord, where should I and my flock go? You know, and the Lord says, well, the road is right there. They say, hey, wait a minute. You know, I was a bishop in the church. And then he says, you weren't where it was at. You know, and somebody else is getting ready to follow the bishop down to hell, and God grabs him and says, hey, fella, you're going the wrong way. He says, all I ever did was shave. Yeah, our Luther's example, you know, all I ever did was keep a clean kitchen. He says, yeah, but, you know, you were singing to me while you swept. See, and Luther and Kierkegaard go so beautifully together in most respects. You know, Luther talks about, and he talks about good works. What does he say? Person who is acting on the love of God, you don't have to tell him what to do. While you're busy telling him what to do, he's already done it and 100 other things. It just sort of comes natural. Okay?
I missed the first lecture. Could you tell me which book I should read first? I've never read any
of this. The book called Stages on Life's Way, Kierkegaard talks about the first stage and the second stage and sort of hints at the third stage.
What, may I make a suggestion to her?
Yeah, sure.
Here are Dr. Lehman's first two lectures on tape. Then you'll be clued right in. It'd be so much easier than reading the book.
Oh, this is good. Now, one thing you can do, you know, if you've never read Kierkegaard, we have a number of Kierkegaard books in the bookstore here, but one is an anthology of selections from his whole career, and it gives you, and the editors already have selected out a bunch of things that'll be interesting to read, and it carries you through the different stages. Okay, well, this as usual has been fun, and you look like you had a good time this morning, so we managed to satisfy the aesthetical needs as well as the religious and ethical. All right, so anyway, your responsibility now is to, you know, is to go back and keep it from sagging down and getting ethical humdrum, you know.
Do a lot
sort
of shaving.
A lot of shaving.
Well, what do the women do then?
You do a lot of dancing.
Dancing, sweep that old kitchen, you know. Let's stick with dancing, because that's not limited to male or female. Okay? Get beyond, you know, do your own thing, get beyond the Arthur Murray footsteps on the floor.